Welcome to Nothing Ventured, a podcast exploring some of the lesser heard stories in tech and venture. Join me, Arish Shah, as I speak to founders, investors, and ecosystem operators, bringing you insights from the roads less traveled. The following episode is a session we held with Hussein Kanji, general partner at Hoxton Ventures, an early stage investment house here in London. We recorded this in front of a virtual audience in June 2021. I hope you enjoy.
Excellent. Welcome, everyone. We will give it 30 seconds or so to let people filter in and then kick off. Really exciting. Intriguingly, I think there's going to be quite a few people I recognize from Twitter in the chat section joining in. Excellent. Cool. Well, look, I think we've got people sort of joining, saying hello and welcome, everyone. Really appreciate you joining us today for this fireside with Hussein Kanji, one of the partners at Hoxton Ventures. Really excited to have Hussein. I maybe had a slight glitch in my connection. Hussein and I have gotten to know each other over the last year or so, and as I say, you know, it's been really interesting understanding his perspective on a number of things, and I'm really glad that we're able to share it with everyone today. So first of all, welcome, Hussein. Great to have you here.
Thanks.
Excellent. So the way we're going to kind of structure this, just for everyone else out there, is, you know, we're going to talk through a number of topics, and then we're going to leave a hefty portion at the back end for Q&A. So please do feel free to put your questions in the chat. We'll be monitoring that, and towards the end of the session, we'll start picking up some of those questions. But Hussein, you just got back from the US, so I just wanted to kind of quickly get a feel from you on, you know, post-COVID US versus the UK or Europe. Like, you know, have things kind of bounced back over there? Did you see anything different in approaches to exiting kind of lockdowns and all of that sort of stuff? Or is it very much the same as what we're seeing over here?
So it feels so much like night and day. So I was in three different states. I was in Wisconsin, I was then in Florida, and then I was in Georgia. Wow. You know, COVID feels very much, I mean, there's still remnants of it. You still, in some places like retail establishments, you have to wear a mask. Restaurants are fully open indoors and outdoors. No one wears a mask inside of any of these. Compliance is different in all of these places. In Wisconsin, compliance is about 47% vaccination. So 53% of people have chosen not to get vaccinated. Which is bizarre to me, but they also was a swing state, and they also wanted to vote Trump, which is also bizarre to me. You see lots of Trump 2024 signs in Wisconsin, which is kind of funny. Florida, I don't know, but like every Walgreens, which is the national kind of pharmacy chain, kind of our Boots equivalent, has a sign saying come in for a vaccine. You know, you don't need an appointment. You can, it's free. It's super easy. You know, in Georgia, My mom's neighbors have a kid who's 12, and he should qualify for the vaccine in about a week, maybe 2 weeks. That's when they're opening up to over 12s. Right now they're over 18s. Georgia, the compliance is 30%. So 30% of people who get a vaccine, you know, can have chosen to take it, which is, again, really bizarre. But Georgia, again, was a swing state. So I think that goes hand in hand. Generally speaking, the news has nothing on COVID. And so I came back to the UK, and last night, you know, we tuned into the BBC, and it's like all COVID news. It's all fear. The US is, you know, it's all India variant or Delta variant or whatever the new variant is that's been called. In America, it feels like COVID's like kind of in the past. Everyone's kind of moving on. Yeah, everything's open, right? Everyone's going back to business. I mean, people are being somewhat cautious to some degree, but it's like they're moving on. Like it's not like, oh, there's another danger and there's another looming lockdown. Like that all feels like 6 months ago, 4 months ago. And I think a lot of it has to do with this vaccine rollout. Although I said, like, you know, despite the rollout, like in both of those two states, the majority of people do not want to take the vaccine. So let's see. but it does it does feel like COVID is more or less behind them. I think I'd much rather, we're probably going to end up making another trip to America, because if London is like this, I mean, although I saw the guidance yesterday saying you're encouraged not to go to an amber country, assuming you're allowed to still go to an amber country for a good reason, I'd just rather be in the US for a month or two while the UK kind of gets its act together on this stuff.
Yeah, I think that's probably the calculus that a lot of people are doing at the moment. Interestingly, my daughter was meant to be going to Costa Rica, and that just got bumped to the red list. We were planning on being in Italy with my wife's family, and we'll see what happens there. But yeah, I think what will be interesting is, you know, the US, it does exactly as you say. It sounds like it's sort of bounced back, and you know, it's, if not business as usual, getting very close to business as usual. And presumably that has some interesting economic kind of impact versus Europe, which is, you know, half and half at the moment. I think, you know, the jobs kind of numbers came out over the last couple of days, and those are really, really positive in the US. So I think that's really cool. And we will talk about a little bit about the difference between the US and the EU from a venture perspective, but I actually wanted to dig in a little bit into kind of, you know, the man behind the name, as it were, right? So you know, you've had a really interesting kind of history and background. You actually, you know, from what I could tell, had very little to do with finance when you kind of first graduated. I think you did like an internship at Merrill's. But then you went straight into kind of startup mode, worked with a lot of, you know, half a dozen or so, I think, early stage or start, you know, pure startups before heading to Microsoft. And then you transitioned into venture thereafter, and not just into venture, but out of the US into venture. So I'd really like to just understand kind of the cadence of that journey, and what were the thought processes that you went through as you made those changes, because for me, that's really intriguing, especially given that I think there's a lot more flexibility around kind of roles and careers and obviously entrepreneurship, which, you know, we'll obviously talk about. So yeah, it'd be really, really cool to understand that.
Yeah, so I spent a summer between high school and college, which, you know, is also code for like just being very young, and so not particularly sophisticated, you know, and I did it on the derivatives desk at Merrill. You know, I was kind of a math person in high school, so that kind of helps get on. I hated it. I mean, you know, I had no idea how much money people made, because you don't really ask that question and people didn't really talk about it all that much. But from a day-to-day perspective, like, I found the job like insanely boring, and I didn't think the people were all that bright. Like, I found it was like a waste of a summer. Like, I would have much rather spent my summer interning at the New York Times, because the other thing I really wanted to do was be a journalist when I was a kid. And you know, going to Merrill was like, I kind of feel like it was a useless summer for me. So that was Merrill. And then I ended up at Stanford, and, you know, just being at Stanford and being in the Bay Area, I ended up interning at a what was a design agency. So that was the other thing that I really liked doing in my kind of youth, was my career paths were journalism. There were probably not finance after the Merrill experience. There were design, like product design or graphic design, or coding, like as in being an engineer at a tech company. Those are kind of my variations. And so in college, I spent almost all my time on the school paper. I was one of the editors. Like, you know, that's, I wrote like in freshman year, like 4 to 5 articles a day. Like, you know, like I was really busy with the paper. And then I spent a summer interning at a design studio. And then my degree was, you know, kind of this sister degree to computer science, which is symbolic systems, which is like half computer science, like half linguistics, psychology, philosophy, everything else kind of added up. So you could see like these things kind of playing out. So the design studio got me into tech, because the studio that I worked for was a early, back then it was CD-ROMs were a thing. So Netscape had just come out. So it was a design studio that made a lot of CD-ROM type content. And then all the CD-ROM type people, all the interactive CD-ROM type people became web designers and graphic designers on the web. And so we did one of those, and we ended up building it. We built a bunch of websites for some, you know, fairly large companies like HP and Apple. And then we sold that business to KPMG. And then that got me into the tech side of startup stuff versus the design side of startup stuff. And so I ended up, you know, doing company stuff. And along the way, I got to know the venture community because, you know, if you're building one of these startups or doing anything to do with startups, you end up interacting with the venture community. And I was like, that sounds like a great job. Like, you know, you basically get to sit back in your chair and listen to people who are a lot brighter than you, right? You know, kind of tell you what they want to build, and then you write them a check, and, you know, you actually don't do any real work. You just write them a check, and you kind of show up, and you get a lot of the credit, you get paid better, and you get all the returns and upside as well. You know, I was like, I want to do that when I grow up. And so I had a long conversation with one of my mentors, about joining his firm. And he was like, look, you shouldn't join the firm. Like, you should only join a firm as a partner. There is no real career path for younger people. And so what you should do is you should spend your 20s and your 30s kind of cutting your teeth, like predominantly your 20s, you know, learning how to build one of these companies. Because if you flunk out of a venture fund, which is what most people who are younger will end up doing, because, you know, it'll only be a 2-year or 3-year kind of program for you, and then they'll go find a newer model of you and replace you, and they're not going to promote you up. You know, you should go spend that. Then you're just going to end up back in a company anyway. You should go start from working in a company. And I'd done a bunch of startups. He was like, you have really good startup experience, but you should go work for a bigger company for a while just to learn how bigger companies kind of think about things and how they build up scale and how they organize. And there's a whole bunch of learnings from there. And that, this is like early 2000s now. And you know, when you think about the great software companies today, you think about the great software companies and the great internet companies kind of interchangeably. Back then, like the internet company of record would have been someone like a Yahoo. Google was just kind of getting started. You know, Adobe was not really all that interesting of a place and hadn't really transitioned to being cloud oriented. Oracle is very much of a sales company versus a product management and engineering company. And so, you know, the best software company in the world at that time was Microsoft. So I reluctantly moved up to Seattle, which is where Microsoft is headquartered. I didn't particularly like Seattle. And I ended up, I thought I'd spend like a year of learning, year and a half kind of learning at Microsoft, and I'd kind of get that check mark and out of all the knowledge, right, and go do something else with my life. I ended up staying at Microsoft for like closer to 4 years, like it was like 3.5 years. And it wasn't until I forcibly pulled myself by going to business school that I kind of left the firm, because they kept giving me stuff to do that was interesting. And it was always like 6 months or years, you know, they keep you around until you kind of eject yourself. And business school is a good reason to eject yourself, because you're leaving to do something else that was productive. It wasn't just another job. And so then I moved to London. And then when I got to London, the same person who kind of sat me down and said, don't become a venture person, introduced me to the partnership at Accel and said, you know, here's a bright young guy who I knew who wants to do venture. And then here's a firm that I really respect, which is Accel in London. And they kind of spent some time with me, and then I helped out on a couple of things, and they helped, you know, they basically gave me an office and said, if you can kind of juggle school and work at the same time, like, we'd love to have you around the office a little bit more. And then there's a very clear trade, which was, you know, as you grow or mature and get better at this, like, we, and, you know, it was after like a few months of this, right, we want to grow you up to be a partner. And that all was going kind of according to plan until we hired some other partners inside the firm. And the problem with firms is their partnerships. And if you're at the bottom of the stack rank, which is kind of where you are when you're a younger person, and there are people at the top of the stack rank, which is the people who you hired, now you have a middle group of people. The middle group of people just conceptually are not going to be the biggest fans of the people at the bottom of the list, because the people at the bottom of the list, if they go up, will become middle of the list. And everyone in the middle of the list is, you know, kind of vying for being at the top of the list. And so you can see how the politics kind of plays out, even in a very small firm. At the time, the firm was only 9 people. But you know, my chance of kind of going up through the ranks was slim to none. Realistically, it was none at that point. And so then I tried to get a job at another venture fund. And true to what George told me ages ago, is there's very little career mobility in venture. So, you know, if you leave one venture firm and you haven't made partner, it's not like you can go join another venture firm and then kind of make partner. So, like, I sat down with Index, for instance, and Index was like, look, you're not like a 20-something, like, young person that we can, like, kind of hire as an analyst. So you're not that interested. You're not a partner, as in, like, you're not a viable, like, returns-producing person in your career. Like, you're a high potential for that, but you're not there yet. So we can't hire you as an equity partner into the firm. and we can't hire you as a junior person in the firm because you wouldn't want that job. You're in between. We're not willing to take the risk of investing into the last year of like your training to have you kind of get promoted up. And they were really blunt about this. The other firms wouldn't even bother meeting with me, which I thought was really quite bizarre. Because, you know, if you're coming out of Accel, I would argue you're probably better trained than 99% of the world, and you've kind of made the bar already. And then because I wanted to stay in Europe, because I thought Europe had a lot of high potential when it came to the tech industry, which wasn't there like 20 years ago. It's better to be in a place where the market itself is maturing, where you're early days in the market and the market's kind of growing up exponentially. That way you don't have to do a lot of the heavy lifting, right? The market kind of pulls you up. And I thought Europe definitely followed that route. And then the only alternative was to set up a firm. You just, if you can't get a job, and, you know, and I went back to the Bay Area to talk to a bunch of firms, and consistently the feedback from the Bay Area firms was, look, you used to be really smart and then you moved up to Seattle. The Bay Area is such a huge, like, you know, it just has such a huge bias for the Bay Area because that's where everything happens. And like, you know, we understand kind of why you went to Seattle, because Microsoft, it's not a bad company, but, you know, you left the Bay Area and then you moved to London, and we don't understand that decision at all because there's nothing in London. And yeah, you joined a good firm, but it's not the same firm as Accel and Palo Alto. You know, it doesn't generate the same kinds of returns. It's not as good of a firm, and we don't really know what you guys do in Europe. And, you know, we think you basically have a virus or a bug, you know, which you got to get out of your system, right? Like, you got to realize that the real life, like, the good stuff happens in the US, not...
A little bit of a freeze there. Hold on.
No problem.
That's okay. Okay, so sorry, you got to get this bug out of your system. So it sounds like a very tribal and actually far more political and traditional corporate kind of structure and kind of recruitment and hiring pattern than I would have expected. You expect venture firms to be slightly more agile and a bit more kind of progressive.
Yeah, so the way most people in the US think about venture, right, is you want to be investing in the best in class companies. The best in class companies, by and large, and by like the mid 2000s and late 2000s, were in the Bay Area, right? And so even like Boston as a center was kind of shutting down. Like the one of the most famous firms in Boston was Greylock. Greylock had already pivoted to being a Palo Alto-centric firm versus a Boston-centric firm. You know, so the shift had moved. The Bay Area kind of won, right? The global landscape, all the good stuff was happening in the Bay Area. And if you were investing in these things and you wanted to hire and you wanted to invest in kind of the A-plus people, like you had this huge bias, which is your home market. And people who wanted to do stuff outside of the Bay Area were, you know, the general consensus in the U.S. was like, there is nothing in the Bay Area. And, you know, if you look, like, almost all the really interesting international deals done from 2000 to 2010 were done by Tiger Global, you know, which is a hedge fund, not even a venture firm, out of New York, which said, you know, which ran the if this, then that kind of strategy, which is like, if it works in the U.S., then it will work somewhere else. And this playbook of like global venture type returns outside of maybe China, and China was kind of its own black box in that respect, was run by very, very, very few firms. And then two of the best firms in the world opened up in London, which was Benchmark and Accel. Benchmark is now Balderton, and Accel is still Accel. And, you know, everyone in the Bay Area kind of has a view on everyone else's returns because they do get shared around by the LP community. Like, you have a sense, you don't, may not know the exact number, but, you know, those two firms were at best mediocre by U.S. venture standards. And so, you know, if you're sitting in a top tier firm in the U.S., it's like, you know, the rest of the stuff doesn't work. The stuff that works is focusing on the Bay Area. And then if you have a person on your team that wants to be in London, you know, you really want to bring someone like that onto the team because they're just going to be unhappy being in the Bay Area. And that's the context at which, you know, and then all your Rolodex stuff has to be in the Bay Area. So if you've been sitting in London for the last 4 years, like, you know, the general view is you don't know anyone that matters in the Bay Area anymore. Like, you used to have those relationships. They've all kind of probably expired by now. And so you have to kind of prove to everybody you're one of them again. And two firms like made me a formal offer saying, look, we'll pay for your salary. We'll give you an office. Like, you know, we'll house you inside the firm. We're not going to talk at all about a career for you, but we'll give you a place to prove to us that you're kind of one of us again. And we'll give you like the year or two, you know, of time to be able to prove that and refresh all these relationships. but you got to get this like European bug out of your system. And, you know, if you end up saying, hey, but I think there's going to be some interesting stuff in Europe, you're just validating that you're a very infected person, you know, and that was a struggle.
So it sounds like Europe continued to bug you because you're still here. So clearly you therefore kind of, it sounds like had the, not the idea, but it sounded like the default then was like, well, I better raise my own fund or create my own firm. So is that what happened? And like, how did you and Rob meet and how did Hoxton, what was the evolution of Hoxton?
Yeah, so that's exactly what happened. So we then sat. So then I was like, okay, it's 2000. This is all like circa 2010. And then, you know, 2005 to 2000, like probably 10, with a lot of activity in kind of 2007, there were a whole bunch of new firms being formed in the U.S. Run by younger partners who are doing kind of these seed funds. They're called them micro venture funds or micro cap venture funds. You know, Softtech, which is now Uncork, is one of these. First Round Capital is one of these. Union Square Ventures is one of these. Floodgate is one of these. And home, you know, there's a firm in the U.S. called Homebrew, which is, you know, kind of jokingly, yeah, it's run by a white guy and a brown guy. The brown guy happens to be from Battery. The white guy happens to be from Google. Right? Hoxton is a white guy and a brown guy. The brown guy happens to be from Accel. The white guy is also from Google. You know, not that dissimilar. And Homebrew was able to go build like $100 million first fund. And we were like, you know, we should be able to do exactly the same thing in Europe. And you know, Europe has this advantage where, unlike in the U.S., and the reason why people had an edge in the U.S. is because the big firms just didn't want to do seed investing. But there were a lot of big firms, you know, in Europe. There's nobody, right, including the big firms. I mean, it's like such a small handful of people back in 2010 that, you know, just turning up is going to get you so much of the way there. And so we tried to explain that pitch to LPs, and it was tough, right? So we said, we can't do a $100 million fund. Let's go do a $25 million fund. We actually started off as three people. So there was a third partner of ours who gave up along the way because it was really, really hard. To go raise this thing, and he ended up forming another fund, which is the kind of one of, to some extent, like a competitor of Hoxton. And I'll leave his name out of it to protect him. But you know, we've done pretty well for ourselves, so I think we've kind of beaten the other firm in terms of returns. But you know, there are three of us, and then you know, then there were two of us, and we kind of persisted. You know, usually when you do this exercise, like you mentally prepare for 12 to 18 months of fundraising. That's kind of standard in venture, especially if you're doing something new. It took us 39 months to put this like fund together. And then in business school, they teach you sunk costs, right? Which is like if you're pushing a rock uphill and it's really going uphill, like after 12 months of wasting your life on it or 24 months of wasting your life on it, like maybe you should cut out, you know, it's sunk costs, right? Like you can't make up for the last 12 or 24 months. But human psychology being what it is, the reason why they teach you about sunk cost, and even if you're, you know, if you know what sunk cost is, right, human psychology is like, I'll just give it another 6 months or 12 months. And to be fair, many successful people have done like crazy things, like just persisting down their path, right? Like Elon Musk mortgaged his house, right, to kind of fund SpaceX, right? Like
he was looking to sell Tesla at one stage, right? I mean,
yeah. They do irrational things, right, to kind of keep themselves alive because they have like a huge conviction in their idea and they ignore the sunk cost. You know, they should be rational, but they're irrational. We were irrational. So like 39 months, we kind of eventually got done. And then we started investing and, you know, it's been easier since then. But you know, it wasn't easy to begin with. And I think in general, Europe has this, like, yeah, it's this very European thing. I think if you're not from the right social class, and I really fundamentally believe this, so which is why I'm saying it. I think if you're not from the right social class in Europe, it's actually really hard to raise money. It's not like America. It is not a fair place compared to the U.S. The U.S. is like 100 times more fair when it comes to, like, there is no class distinction. There is class in the U.S. but it's nowhere near as bad. So I think if we were the son of like a rich family, or, you know, we're not daughters because we're not women, but like, you know, if we're the son of a rich family, it would have been infinitely easier. Or if we went to school with a bunch of kids who are from rich families, it would be infinitely easier. But that's not the case, I think, in Europe. And then I think there's a bias for older people. Like, we sat down with the British Business Bank in the early days and they told us, you know, we should come back to them in 10 years after having worked, you know, in proper jobs. And they funded Episode One instead of us. I mean, we were fundraising roughly around the same time that the two firms are being created at the same time. And, you know, Episode One was run by largely more experienced, older, you know, more British people than ourselves. And, know, I think at this point, our returns kind of speak for themselves, especially when compared to many of the other funds that got funded around that time. You know, I don't think there's that much of a risk culture on taking a bet on a younger, newer, you know, less experienced is weird because we're coming out of exactly the right places where you would think venture people should come out of. But there was this huge bias, right, towards age, I think, in the UK.
Yeah, no, I was just going to say, so does that flow through, do you think? Because it's interesting because you're talking about the LP side, you know, and LPs coming into your funds. Does that flow through, do you think, into founders as well? So are the funds, the UK and European funds, less, are they more risk averse? I mean, that's always been, I think, part of the narrative here is that, you know, UK, Europe, like, you know, the old adage is in the Bay Area, they'll fund a deck. In New York, they'll fund revenue. But in the UK and Europe, you've got to, you know, they'll only fund profit. Is that, you know, it's obviously very tongue in cheek, but is that part of the edge that you guys bring, I guess, is being able to come in earlier and take those slightly riskier bets?
Yeah, I think that's definitely the bias. I mean, I think the more east you go until you get to China, the risk culture is significantly reduced. I think the German risk culture is even more risk averse than the UK risk culture, which is different than the New York one. And there's a huge difference between New York and California, you know, and the idea of taking bets on more unproven up and coming founders is, you know, I think there's a bias. Like, I think, you know, Alex Chesterman and Kazoo is easy to fund for most people. You know, Will Hsu is less easy to fund. In fact, if I remember correctly, I don't even think some of the venture funds even met with Deliveroo in the early days, right? Because it was too raw, too immature. And, you know, kudos to Index for doing it from the very beginning. But, like, I don't think that was true for most of the European firms. Now, again, this is all changing. Like, you know, Europe is looking a lot more like the U.S. today. This is all, like, circa 2010, 2012, 2014, right? You know, we don't look the same. I think people have understood why venture works. There's also a lot of money coming in. There's a lot more groups kind of forming. So, you know, the market looks significantly different today than it did in the past. But yeah, back then it was incredibly risk averse compared to the way it was today. And, like, you know, we joke, like, we put up our stats, like, on diversity. Like, we're not a diversity fund. Like, I really honestly don't care so much about the ESG stuff. Like, I think it's basically, and it's an excuse for, like, rich white women to be able to raise funds. Like, that's my view of ESG. You know, but our ESG numbers are really high, like, compared to the industry average, and they're much higher than many of the ESG funds. Because I think we look past all this stuff. Like, we don't really care if the person's an immigrant. We don't really care if the person's a minority. We don't really care if the person's a woman. What we really care about is, like, can they build something extraordinary? And if we think they have the potential, we write the check. And if you're trained to do this off of a sheet of paper, so super early days, you know, all of that stuff doesn't matter as much to you, right? It's all about potential. You're basically investing on potential versus anything else. And potential can come out of anyone, kind of anywhere. We have a huge amount of investments now in Eastern Europe. Mm. And, you know, that's all, like, kind of high potential, right? Because those economies are not that big. And many of those countries, like, we funded someone in Belarus. Like, Belarus is a mess right now. Like, you can't take any kind of bet on Belarus as an economy, just given what's happening politically. But you can bet on the people who are coming out of Belarus. And, you know, sure enough, they've had to move to the UK and they're moving over to California. But that's all part of the journey in our mind.
Yeah, I mean, that's a really interesting take. So from your perspective, diversity flows through because you've already looked past, I guess, you've gotten over the fact that there needs to be kind of a prescriptive way of doing it. Your attitude is that we just fund the best in class, irrespective of who they are, where they're from. And because we look at everything and everyone, we don't. You know, we don't necessarily therefore lose out because our top of the funnel is big enough that we're getting the right deals coming through. So I guess what that tells me is that, you know, Hoxton is a friendly fund. And what I mean by that is, and I remember because I think I met you 4 years ago, you gave me your card at some really random event. And all I remember about the event was there was some sort of like AR a medical device. I think it was like training doctors or something at the time, surgeons. But the point is, I think you gave me your card, and I guess the question I'm asking is for founders out there that are looking to raise their kind of pre-seed, is Hoxton the right place to be looking? Do you look at everything? What are the red flags? What are you not looking for, I guess, which is, you know, everyone asks what you are looking for. What aren't you looking for? Because I think that's really important to understand.
So the what we aren't looking for ties really much. We have a pretty simple heuristic, which we write on our website, but I don't think anyone reads that page. So we've got to redesign it. I think we're very focused on brand new market creation. So everything else for us is kind of noise, right? So if you're building a company and there isn't a good reason or a good explanation of why you think that company could be built today, where it could not have been built a year ago, 2 years or 5 years ago, and you can't explain why there's a big new market that's kind of growing ahead of you, it's not our thing. Like, we don't really do better mousetraps. Like, you know, if you can say I'm building a better version of Salesforce, like, that's great. Like, you know, just not interesting to us. You know, for us, we're trying to find brand new sites. So like, my last deal was a protein engineering company, right? They can run artificial intelligence against disordered proteins. They can simulate them, and they can create alternative like disordered proteins that then bind to those proteins. And you just could not run that computation, and even really, really large research groups like DeepMind can't do this kind of work. It's fundamentally meant. Now, what the heck you do with this is an open question, right? The business model for this is you sell this as software to pharma companies and get kind of a services fee or a license fee, you know, as a subscription fee. Do you go become a drug discovery company of your own kind? Like, you know, what do you do with this? You know, these things are fuzzy in the early days when you're in a brand new market, but we're talking about brand new markets where we think the company can be distinctive. And then we're only looking for companies in Europe that we think are going to win that market. So, you know, you're on a global stage. There's a bunch of really great companies from Israel. There are a bunch of really good companies from other parts of Europe. There are a bunch of really great companies in the US and a lot of them in California. Right. So why do we think that the company that's being born in kind of a second tier market, which is what Europe is, right? Because we don't have the same advantages that California does. Like, why do we think the company from this side of the pond is going to be able to beat every single other person in all these other places? And if there's not a good reason for that, then it's also a pass. So for us, it's new markets, and then companies that can become the winners in those new markets, and everything else is in kind of noise for us.
I think that's really interesting, and it's something that I talk to a lot of founders that we work with about. Like, I think there is an assumption amongst a lot of people that venture capital is there to fund all businesses, and I think the response I always give to a lot of founders is, no, it's not. It's venture capital is about funding businesses that scale fast, scale rapidly, and can effectively return the fund, right? So like, you aren't looking for, if you've got 10%, you know, if you've got $100 million fund and you own 10% of a venture, you really want, you want to, you know, assuming no further dilution, you need that business to exit at a billion. Otherwise, it's not going to return the dynamics that you need it to. So that's really interesting.
And from a returns perspective, I was just chatting with a friend of mine before this over WhatsApp. Like, he's a hedge fund guy who's about to do his investment, and he was arguing with me about this. I was like, you can take my 10 years of venture history and put it in a box. Like, you know, I'm just telling you what we do, right? And you can do it your own way if you want, but there's no point in asking me about what you do if you kind of want to do it. He wanted to run a DCF or an NPV type calculation, yeah, you know, like on the cash flows, and then look at kind of public market comps and kind of work backwards. You know, we don't think like that. For us, it's, you know, we own whatever, 10%, 15% of a business. You know, when we make our investments, maybe it's like 20%, but it'll get diluted to 10%. You know, every single one of our investments has to be able to return the fund. So in other words, if we own 10%, we manage about $100 million. You know, if we don't think that business is going to become worth a billion in the future, it's just not interesting to us. Now, you know, these are arbitrary numbers, right? If a business could be worth a billion, who's not to say it can't be worth a billion and a half? I mean, you know, it's either going to get large or not get large. And if it's not going to get large, it's not interesting. It's a pass for us. And that's why we focus so much on these new markets and these kind of category winners. And, you know, in Europe, there's a whole bunch of businesses that will get large off of doing the execution playbook, right? Rocket Internet kind of showed this, and, you know, right now, there's a bunch of Amazon roll-up type businesses, right? People trying to, you know, find small mom and pop sellers on Amazon. You know, we philosophically just don't like the copycat type businesses. So you can make money, I think, copying businesses in the US and kind of localizing them in Europe. And the depth of the tech markets today is much higher than the depth of the tech markets like a few years ago. In other words, you can build a $1 billion company, I think, focused on executing that playbook in Europe. You don't need to be global these days to become $1 billion companies. But, you know, our view is like, if we're going to try and turn, and this does permeate our thinking, and I don't think there's any shame in this, right? If we're going to try and become billionaires off of our own fund, and many of the really, really successful venture people in the Bay Area are billionaires, and they're not billionaires having been founders, been billionaires, they're billionaires in their own right from having invested in these kinds of companies. You know, $1 billion is interesting, but, you know, on a 20% carry pool, you know, that's a $200 million paycheck, divide by two, that's $100 million. These are phenomenally high sums of money. You know, you're in the top 0.1%, whatever the number is, you know. But if you're going to try and get to $1 billion each, right, you're going to have to generate $2 billion of wealth, yeah, which means at a 20% carry, you're going to have to create like $10 billion of wealth. You know, we're trying to find companies that are going to be, and these days, I think in the tech markets, it's not insane to say, I'm going to try and build $10 billion, $50 billion, $100 billion companies. You can do this when you invest into exceptional companies. Whereas like 20 years ago, it was hard enough to get to $1 billion, which is why unicorns were so rare. I think the markets are deep enough these days, especially where you have public market companies that are worth like $1-2 trillion. You can go build startups that start from scratch, and 10 years later, it could be worth like $10-50 billion. We're trying to find those companies, and our mind is those companies are not going to be the Amazon clone, the Amazon roll-up clones. They're going to be distinctive companies in brand new sectors, which we don't even know about today, right? Which are going to be the sectors of tomorrow, where they're going to be the winners in those sectors. And that's how you think you're going to get really, really, really high value. And you see it, by the way, between Deliveroo and DoorDash. Like, right? You look at DoorDash, it's a $45 billion company. You look at Deliveroo, it's like a $5 to $6 billion company. There's a huge difference between the two of them. We're early investors, super happy, but like, you know, you want to be the win. You want to find the winning company in the space that's the biggest company in the space globally, and that's the one that you want to be kind of behind, because that's how you really get the venture returns that you're shooting for.
So that's really interesting, and I guess that kind of leads on to, just before we get onto the kind of Q&A, and there's a few questions stacking up here, but you know, two IPOs and a reverse merger all in the space of sort of 3 or 4 months. You know, first of all, congratulations. So Deliveroo, obviously IPO, Darktrace similarly IPO'd, and Babylon Health looking to go into a reverse merger into a SPAC. What I guess the questions are, what stood out when you first invested? And equally, you know, now that they've kind of, they're on that exit path, was that something that had been planned? Or, you know, the timing obviously seems like a bit like London buses, you know, nothing and then three turn up in one go. What kind of triggered those, do you think?
Well, we're in a bull market right now, and we're also in a market where I think the IPO window has been open now for a little bit of time, and it takes time for companies to mature. So these companies needed a few years to be able to mature. They've all matured in terms of, they're all pretty sizable businesses, you know, in terms of like their revenue numbers. So they could have gone public, you know, any time in the last like year. They could also go public like next year or the year after, but you don't know when the market's going to be this good or this open. So they've all kind of timed it around now. That's coincidence. It's the London bus problem. You know, it's not a problem. It's a good thing. But you know, these are all investments that we made back in 2014 or 2015. So, you know, these are not new investments for us by any stretch. And I always find it funny that there are a bunch of venture firms that will end up buying in, like doing secondary or participating in like a Series E, and it's a seed stage firm. And there's like a top 10 seed list that Sifted wrote, and one of the firms.
Where you're an analyst, right? I think in that.
Yeah. That's because that's what it says on my LinkedIn. But you know, that particular firm, I think, bought Series E stock in Deliveroo, and because they're a seed firm, right? The world thinks that they were a seed investor in Deliveroo versus like the Series E, you know, Series E investor, whatever. I mean, we don't buy logos, right? Like, we only do these things like there's only one stage where we can really invest, maybe two if you include pre-seed. So pre-seed and seed, if we miss it on pre-seed or seed, you know, it's too late, too expensive, not worthwhile enough for us to kind of participate. And so we don't tend to do them. So our buy-in price is only at one point. So you kind of really have to get it right at that point. Otherwise, you don't have a second shot. It's one of the beauties, I think, of being inside of a bigger firm like an Index or an Accel. You get multiple shots at goal, because even if you miss it at seed, you can do it at A or you can do it at B. We're just not big enough as a firm to be able to do that. And we don't manage enough capital. So you know, our capital is just too precious for that.
It makes sense. And I mean, what, like, if you had to think back to those first investments, like, or those, 2014 and 15 when you first invested in those businesses, what was it that stood out? Like you said, you know, Will Shuer, Deliveroo, like many firms, maybe didn't even look. What stood out to you that said to you, this is worth taking a bet on?
They were all brand new markets, so they didn't exist. So the most skeptical of the people would probably say, well, food delivery is not a new market, right? That was Just Eat. And if people really remember history, which unfortunately most people don't, but having been a little bit older in this cycle, I do, right? There was a company in New York called Cosmo, which was trying to do exactly what Deliveroo did. They raised like $200 million in the dot-com bubble, New York, urban density, et cetera. And they failed miserably. Like they burned through it was like a dot-com poster child, right? For excess. It was, I think, at one point the largest drug dealing network in New York, because the people who signed up to do the deliveries realized they could do a side hustle of selling marijuana, because right. The people who are purchasing food at it was more like an Instacart than a food delivery business. So right. People were ordering like Ben and Jerry's at 10 o'clock and spending $7 on a service fee, right? Might also want something else with their Ben and Jerry's. So it was good for them, but bad for the business and bad for everybody else. And the reason why it didn't work back then is it was really hard to run a fleet. You are running a logistics operation more than anything else, and it's impossible to run a logistics operation unless you're able to make sure you can get the driver from where they're picking up whatever it is to the house in as short as possible time, and you do multiple kind of deliveries an hour as you possibly can. And the reason why Just Eat never went into the delivery business until very recently is it's hard to run the logistics business. It's really quite difficult. And you couldn't do it pre-smartphone. And you really honestly couldn't do it pre-cheap smartphone, because if the smartphones were really expensive, you couldn't give them to the drivers. And so, delivery spent a lot of time in the early days building the infrastructure behind the scenes to run the logistics operation. When we invested, way back 2014, they didn't have a mobile responsive website. And this is at 2014, people did have smartphones. So if you use their app on a smartphone or on a tablet, you'd have to pinch and zoom, right, multiple times to be able to order your food. If you're on a browser, you were fine. Like on the desktop, you were fine. But on a device, it was quite tough. And there was no mobile app until like 2015. So, where were they spending all their tech dollars? It was all on the infrastructure behind the scenes to do the logistics and to use those smartphones to track the drivers and to make sure they're doing logistics really well. Darktrace, when we invested in Darktrace, like there was a market category called security information enterprise management. And basically, Darktrace is like a fancy alarm system for the corporate network. So when it sees like weird behavior on the corporate network, it kind of rings the bell and tells you. And like most alarm systems, it has to worry about false positives and false negatives. So false positives being like if your cat goes in front of the alarm system and the alarm rings, you'll get really frustrated with your alarm system because it will just get annoying. And so you have to tune the false positives out. And false negatives are if a burglar comes into your building and the alarm doesn't ring, it's a defective alarm system.
Not a great alarm.
And so the way people were doing it way back in the day was the alarm was a set of rules. So you wrote down all the conditions. So like if this wire trips, then ring the bell. If this thing trips, and people would maintain like 10,000 rules, like 20,000 rules in like a little file. And that was SIE, and SIEM was the software that managed all the rules that, then ran the rules against the corporate network. Like, Darktrace said, we don't need any rules. Like we're going to self-learn. We'll train ourselves and we'll ring the bell and we'll get really good at both the false positives and the false negatives. The entire market size for SIEM, like the total addressable market for SIEM, if you looked at all the vendors in the world selling software, was $300 million. So there was $300 million of annual spend. And I remember talking to a bunch of other venture folks about this, saying like, there's no way Darktrace is ever going to become a big company because the entire TAM is $300 million. And I'm like, if you have a system where you have to write the rules and then you have a system where you have to do nothing, you just install the software, the thing that installs the software is going to be a lot bigger than the thing where you have to maintain the rules, because the market size for the people maintaining the rules is it's fundamentally a different product in my mind. And true enough, like when Darktrace went public, it's on a $300 million run rate, $250 million of kind of trailing revenue. So, either they own like 99% or 95%. Or the market is massively expanded because you built some fundamental technology. And so, people who look at this stuff in a fixed lens perspective don't often realize that these markets really kind of grow if you can get the pieces together. And I would argue the piece together that you really needed was you needed that automation of that artificial intelligence to do the rule writing for you. so that you didn't have to train the system. And that's what Darktrace did. So brand new market again. And Babylon is even the biggest new market, right? What they're really trying to do is reinvent general practice medicine. And if you think about the way general practice medicine or primary care medicine in the US works, right? It's you go and physically see a doctor and then you go get the referral if there's something wrong with you. You know, if you could suspend disbelief for a second and say, if I'm going to redesign this thing from scratch and I'm going to start with an online offering first, obviously you do telemedicine because that's what Babylon is kind of known for, but you also like automate the heck out of the stuff behind the scenes. So when a doctor sees you, there are things that they have to fill up on a computer to do the referral, to do the pharmacy stuff. Like all of that stuff can be completely, totally automated with like RPA, robotic process automation. So you can make the doctor spend almost all of their time seeing the next patient versus doing the paperwork behind the scenes, you know, before they see the next patient. And then you can do a bunch of diagnostics type stuff ahead of the schedule, and that's where Babylon often gets into trouble because, you know, the future is not going to look like today. And if the software is not as robust today, you have to take a view that, you know, the software can get much more robust, especially if you kind of understand the tech or the science behind it. What happens today is usually not indicative of what AI is going to look like a year from now or 2 years from now. The field is so changing so fast, and we're able to do so much more with this stuff. So you actually can do, I think, a lot of these diagnostics over the long term. And then the other thing that you can do is, like, if you think about like blood draws or like just going to the clinic to do the labs for this stuff, you know, in an offline GP model, the process is very different. Or you go to a waiting room, you're kind of waiting around, the nurses have to see. If you started with this online model first, you could completely streamline having someone come in, you know, just do the blood draws and get out of there. And so you can redesign physically how a clinic looks when you actually build clinics, taking into account like how you'd actually design a GP kind of in the modern era. And that's ultimately what they want to do. They want to redesign the way a GP works. And the GP is not a particularly great business. It's like a 10% margin business. It's not a high margin business. So I think you could redesign the GP and make it a lot more higher margin. And that's how you actually create a ton of the value. I think most people don't understand the story that well behind Babylon because it requires you to say, hey, the way medicine works today is not going to be the way medicine works 10 years from now. And you're building the 10 years from now product today. And then you get into trouble because what's available today is not really what's going to be available the full 10 years. And you might be overselling the vision a little bit. But, you know, this kind of stuff excites us, right? Because you're brand new market, brand new sector. And there was a fundamental reason at the time that we thought Babylon would win in the UK, which is the NHS. It turned out to not be the case because I think the NHS is just way too political and way too slow and cumbersome. And Babylon's generating like almost all their earnings or revenue are coming from the US, not from the UK, which is disappointing, right? Because like we would be a great test case for this. And the reason why you want to do this is, you know, the NHS today is, it's not really national healthcare, it's national sick care. Because you go to the NHS when you're sick. And what you really want to do is if you can build the GP model to be really efficient. Exactly. And that's a fundamental shift. And I think that will make a huge difference towards like how actually the health system works. Because otherwise it just grows faster than inflation and it gets more expensive over time. And so there's a real need as a society to invent stuff like Babylon to streamline this and make it much more preventative. But then you need a new business model to kind of be able to take advantage of all this stuff and to compensate yourself for this stuff. So, you know, but these kinds of things where, you know, in my mind, Babylon is either going to be $100 billion company, like a ridiculously high number, or a zero, like it's going to fail along the way. It's not one of these things that becomes like $1 billion company because it's not an execution driven thing where there's like a finite model. They're either going to reinvent healthcare and become really large or they're not, and they're going to fail along the way and someone's going to end up having to acquire them.
Right. No, that's super interesting. So I'm going to pause for about 5 seconds. We're going to take some Q&As. So, first of all, thank you. That was absolutely amazing. So incredible to hear that. And I'm sure there's much more we could talk about. What we'll try and do with the Q&A is get through quite a few questions. We've only got like 10, 15 minutes left of the session. I'm going to just take one that and maybe if we can do these almost as quick fire, Hussein, that would be great. But one of the questions we got kind of pre-launch of this fireside was, and I think it's really relevant based on some of the stuff you talked about, what would you prioritize when you're looking at a venture? Would you prioritize users over revenue or vice versa? What's more important?
Almost always users over revenue, because users, the revenue is a the financial model, the P&L is not the thing that you're optimizing for, because the P&L is a consequence of how the business is doing. It's not the driver. In a big company, the P&L is the driver. Like, you sit inside a big company, you optimize your budget because you know where you're right. going to grow. In a small company, the P&L is a derivative of underlying things in the business that then generate the P&L. So the P&L it's not the cause, it's the outcome. Effect. It's the effect. And so what I want to see is, you know, a P&L which is wildly wrong in the right direction, which is to say that, you know, your numbers are growing so fast that you have to keep reforecasting because the P&L is kind of out of date. And that happens with traction, and users in many of the consumer internet companies are a proxy for traction. It may not be users, right? Maybe your enterprise sales team or your field sales team is that much more efficient, so you want to go hire 20 more salespeople. And if you do that, you'll massively blow the bottom line, or you'll blow the OPEX line of your P&L, but you'll also blow apart the top line of the P&L. You know, the P&L is an effect, right? It's not if you're GE, the P&L is the P&L, because you can model all this stuff and you can't grow that fast, et cetera. But that's not true in early stage companies.
Yeah, no, it makes a lot of sense, and why we're building what we're building. But anyway, that's another story. So we're going to take some questions here. We've got a few. First question: you operate arguably the leanest seed fund in the UK, if not the world. How do you do it? You've just hired a COO in the last 12 months, I think. Is that right? So it was two partners up until now, and now a third. Yeah, it'd be great to understand how.
Yeah, so I was looking at this. I don't think we're all that lean by venture standards of venture firms have become a lot bigger over the last few years because people have started investing in like content marketing and services and recruiting and all the other good stuff that go, because the economy is really competitive in the venture market. So if you don't have those services, you kind of have to replicate what Andreessen Horowitz has to do. But you know, if you rewind 10 years ago, and I was trying to find a venture firm to kind of explain this to people, and the names I gave have all kind of built up editorial teams, et cetera, so I can't use them anymore. But if you look at Greylock, so Greylock is a good one, Reid Hoffman's firm. Yeah. It's like, I think it's like 9 people. It might be like 12 people. It's really small. They don't have a lot of this stuff in their firm. They manage 4 billion of AUM. And I think that number is actually out of date. I think it's actually closer to 6 billion of AUM because they raised a new fund. So, you know, a fund that's managing like a lot more capital than Hoxton, right? Whether it's 4 or 6, it's a lot more capital, is doing it with a team that's maybe like 4 times the size of Hoxton. We're 100 million, right? So 100 million to 4 billion, like that's a 40x difference. And there's only like a 4x difference in teams. You know, I think a lot of the venture firms are not that big. Now, that said, I think what people...
But then you have like Andreessen, who are the other like outlier in the other direction, I guess.
Yeah. So Tiger Global in its heyday, like, and they had like spectacular returns doing international investing, which meant that they were doing stuff all around the world, right? Which would mean that they would need to go cover all the world, was basically two guys. It was Lee Fixel, who's now gone to do Audition, and then he had a junior, and I think at one point he hired a third junior. I had a friend who interviewed with him, got the job, and then ended up leaving to go to a startup, who I think was his third junior. But it was a tiny, tiny, tiny team that was generating, I think their average return is like about 25% IRR, and they've been doing that consistently for like the better part of 2 decades now. You know, so they're really good at what they do, and I don't think Audition is all that big, which is Lee's new team. You know, venture firms are not designed to be like, unless you're going to do all this like extra services type stuff, it's a judgment business. And I would argue if you're doing seed investing versus like series C investing, there's a bunch of work that you need to do before you make a decision. So either you outsource it by hiring advisors and you have a consulting firm kind of come in, that's the way private equity firms kind of work, or you do it in-house and you have your army of associates or analysts kind of do the work in-house before you make a decision. And you know, you'd be irresponsible if you don't look at everyone's statements like in more depth, right? Because why would you write a $50 million ticket into a business that's doing $50 million in revenue without looking at where the revenue is coming from? If you're an early stage business and there's zero revenue,
you just got to figure out whether the market's big enough and can these guys execute, right?
Exactly. There's no work. There's work to do, but there's no like diligency type work to do on the financials. The diligence work is like you call up people who are in the business and you figure out. So like when Darktrace comes in and walks through the door, you know, how do you know that this this SIEM market is not going to be fixed. And how do you know that this new thing that they've built can actually really radically expand the market? Like, you've got to talk to insiders in the industry. And you know, most cybersecurity businesses, like, their stuff all feels kind of similar to other cybersecurity businesses. So how do you know that Palo Alto Networks or FireEye are not going to, they don't have the Darktrace like feature set in their next generation product kind of pre-built? You know, the only way to do this, and the way the industry works in California, which is why I think Europe actually fundamentally has a disadvantage, is all the people know each other. So they pick up the phone and they call their friends and their classmates and their colleagues who are now executives at those companies, and they collect insider information. Now, it's really legal insider information, unlike the public markets. But the reason why I think Europe defaults to the clones is because when you can't collect insider information, the next generation interesting business looks just really risky. When you can collect, when you're Sequoia, and you can call up your peers at other people, who are on the company side versus on the venture side, and figure out this new thing is actually quite novel, quite distinctive, it's really easy to sit down and write the $10 million check, right? Because you have enough information to justify it. When you're in Europe and you can't do that, you're like, oh, I've seen this thing work in the US, and now I can go build the UK equivalent or the German equivalent. It's a very different framing, I think. And so if you're not a partner, if you're not senior enough to be able to make those calls, you can't really delegate that to like a 22-year-old kid out of Oxford and say, okay, I don't know anyone at Cisco, so you go on LinkedIn and you go find like the senior VP who's in charge of that division, and you get him on the phone and find out, you know, if they've got a Darktrace competitor brewing in their organization. Like, no one's going to tell you. Like, you know, you can be like the most gifted 22-year-old. You're not going to get that answer. The only way you're going to get that answer is if the senior VP happens to be someone that you know, like, in your college days.
Very close relationship. Yeah. So that makes sense. So basically you're lean, not even by design. It's just you have no need for additional.
Yeah. Although that said, I would love to be like a 5 or 7 person partnership versus a 3 person partnership now, because
what's the feed now, like, just explode with kind of requests?
but the challenge for us is we're $100 million fund. So to sustain a 7 person or 6 person or 5 person partnership would have to be a $200 million fund or a $300 million fund. And then if we're a $300-400 million fund, that we're not going to be doing seed investing anymore. We're going to be doing Series A investing and Series B investing, and the whole model shifts away from seed, you know, into A's and B's, and then you look like a different firm. So there's this natural tension where you want to be a little bit bigger, but if you become that much bigger from an AUM perspective, like an assets under management perspective, then you shift your strategy and you're not seed anymore. So you know, the right number probably.
It's a conflict. To grow, you'd have to change literally the operating nature of the firm, which is not what you want to do.
Exactly. And I think you could run seed effectively until about 200 million, and above 200 million, it starts to break. So at 200 million, you might see Hoxton go from like this 2+1, you know, 2 partners plus a COO, to maybe a 4+1 type configuration. But, you know, in order for us to be 7+1, you know, you'd have to be a 400 million fund. And then if you're 400 million fund, you're not doing seed anymore.
Amazing. So we're getting close to an hour. We're going to do another couple of questions. If you're happy to continue Hussein, that'd be great. Because there's a couple of really interesting ones. One that I'll come back to. But one question someone in the audience had was... from Zubair, he wanted to know if you could choose one job or experience or course which provided you with the skills you use most in venture today in 2021, which would you highlight and why, based on like the career and the path you've had?
I mean, that's a good question. I don't think there's any one like course or anything. Like venture, like if you read the Peter Thiel book, 0 to 1, I think that's all you really need to read to understand how venture stuff works. And then the rest is like, you know, the theory behind venture is really easy. Like if you want the second book, it's Brad Feld's book on venture term sheets, venture law. Like between those two books, you have all the mechanics that you need. Then the question is judgment. And the judgment is largely shaped up as the sum of your experiences in the past and your Rolodex in the past. And so it's not any one thing. It's all of the little experiences that you kind of had along the way and all of the people that you met along the way you can then call. Which is why I think venture is not a great job for people in their 20s. It's a really good job once you're in your 30s and in your 40s. And I think it gets increasingly harder in your 50s because you're way too removed from all the newer entrepreneurs. Like you know, a 50-year-old or a 60-year-old is not going to really get TikTok when TikTok walks in the door. Even hands up, like if TikTok walked in the door today, I wouldn't get it. And I'm not even 50, like I'm 44. But like, you know, I'm just too far removed from how young people consume content. And it's the young people who kind of drive many ways the future of the industry. So, you know, you get diminishing returns as you get older, and you get increasing returns as you get, you know, the 20s. And if you do it too prematurely, then you've got to do everything on the job. Whereas I think like kind of between 20 to 20, like eight, you can learn a lot of this stuff by being in the trenches. It's the same advice I got, right? You learn how all these things work, and then you're really productive in your 30s investing.
Yeah, amazing. We've got a question from Ian. What was the most innovative, interesting way that a founder has got your attention?
All the interesting, innovative ways have largely backfired. We remember them because they're distinctive, but they're not particularly effective when it comes to actually getting the check. You know, the most impressive person, we're on the 8th floor of a building today, and in our past, we were on the 7th floor of a building, and you have to get through ground security, which at that point was land security, right, which is the lease owner. And then you had to get up, you had to find a way to badge into the elevator, which is on a different floor. And then you have to get up to the 7th floor and get past the receptionist to get into our office. Anyway, someone made it all the way up to leave a present on our desk, which to be fair was like kind of like chutzpah, right? Like to be able to talk, like social engineer your way all the way up to the 7th floor of a building where there's security on kind of every single one of these things, you know, to put something on our desk. We weren't in the office at the time. So, you know, which happens a lot, right? It's kind of a useless endeavor in terms of actually getting the commitment, and kind of scary because like you now have a stalker, like, or a potential stalker. You know, kudos to them for doing all the work. Like, we did the meeting. It wasn't a business that was investable in our mind, but you know, kudos to them for having like the courage to kind of and do all that. And, like, lots of hustle there, right? But not great. You know, the best stuff for us is like people picking up the phone and saying, this is a super interesting business. They're in totally a new market, right? It's someone that's kind of already in our extended network who kind of gives us the call saying, you have to meet these guys or girls. Like, they're totally on top of like a new thing, and you should spend some cycles with them. Like, you know, we leave the door open for everybody, but like that's the best. Oh, I lost you again.
Hey, sorry. Yeah, you leave the door open, but at the end of the day, it's the business. Presumably, it's the business stroke, the founders, and the opportunity that counts, not how you got through the door, right?
Correct.
And just as a kind of final, like, so the flip of that is, in the early days, we've got a question here from Taz. In the early days, how did you get into those deals? Like, how did you make yourselves known in the marketplace that you're open for business?
So Will at Deliveroo had a classmate from his undergrad who is a friend of mine. Will was still in business school brainstorming the idea that became Deliveroo, you know, wanted to brainstorm with a few other people. So we were on a sounding board. So we saw him that way. Ravine, who used to be Ali's COO at Babylon, was a colleague of Rob's at Google. And so Rob contacted Ravine and said, I'd really like to meet Ali. And then Dark Trace was, we got introduced to him by a family office, and we went to talk to them, and they said, we don't want any venture money. We think all you guys are kind of, you know, not particularly nice people, and you have really strong opinions, and we don't really need you because we've built a company before, and we know what we're doing. And then it was a bunch of salesmanship on my side to convince them that we were actually going to be valuable. And, you know, it was a polite, they took the meeting out of politeness to basically throw us out, right? And hear us out and throw us out. And that ended up turning into a pretty big investment for us. So, you know, we clearly got along and said some stuff there. We actually gave them a lot of information about the growth of another company that wasn't quite a competitor, but was comparable enough. And they went off and researched what we told them. And they realized a lot of the stuff we told them was actually really insightful. It wasn't information in the public domain. And they then tweaked their model to encapsulate a lot of the learnings that we kind of gave. And they said, you're going to be a value add investor for us, as in there's stuff that you know about that we don't know about. Even if we know a lot of stuff and we can do 99% of this ourselves, that extra 1% might actually be, you know, useful enough for you to be able to have you as an investor. And we'll dilute for that reason.
Amazing. We're going to do one final question. And I think what we might do is drop you an email with all the balance that are there and see if we can get you to make a few comments. But I think this is one that will probably be pretty interesting for everyone, which is there a common trait amongst the founders that you invest in? What is the thing that you look for in the person? So the market is one thing, but we all know that execution is pretty key. So what is the thing that you look for in the founders when you're making decisions?
Yeah, so we had an in-house kind of coaching session this morning. So between us and kind of our coach, and you know, we're meeting as a group, including some of our venture partners, and they said this other venture firm looks for people who are, they're very driven, but they're almost kind of mentally, like, they're kind of oddball characters, right? That they're almost not too nice. You know, they're so driven that they're almost like not the nicest people in the world. And that's kind of the heuristic that they look for on their founders. I think our founders, some of them are like that. Some of them are like super, super, super nice people. And this person was telling us, you know, they passed on, this firm ended up passing on one of our other investments because the founder was too nice, and they loved the business, but they couldn't get past the last 5% because they thought the founder was almost too nice and wasn't mentally kind of, you know, this broken person.
Rigid enough.
I think for us, what's mattered more than the founders is the people that they hire around themselves. So we found consistently that really great founders are able to pull other really exceptional people out of jobs. And whether the founders are nice or the founders are like, you know, so driven that they're maniacal was the word that our venture partner used for that particular firm. You know, whether they're maniacal or they're just like really sweethearts, you know, it doesn't matter, right? It matters like who they end up surrounding themselves with. And, you know, there's this old saying that A people hire A people, you know, B people hire C people hire D people. And you see that, right? And you don't get people joining young early stage companies unless there's something special about that company or something special about the founder. And so you see, and so who they hire says a lot more to us. Like, so they could be like a dropout from college, right? You know, 21 years old or 20 years old, but if they're able to then surround themselves with extraordinary people, you know, they're probably more likely to succeed than not, right? These companies are largely built off of a good idea, which the founders, we can figure out if the founders have or not, capital, which kind of is coming from us in many ways or other people downstream, and then people. And so, you know, we can screen the idea, we can write the check for the capital. The people is the one that is really hard to solve for, because that's what you're effectively betting the company and the founders to be able to do. And if they're able to hire those kinds of people, they're on to something really great, because, you know, it's not that hard to build one of these companies if you have those three ingredients.
That is absolutely amazing. And I mean, certainly the lessons that I've learned in 15 years of running businesses one way or the other, and certainly the last 5 or 6 years in tech and venture, is that it's all about the teams, right? And you know, that's something that certainly, as I've been building, you know, the ventures that I am, you know, is top of mind. So look, I would really like to thank you, Hussein, for joining us today. You know, there's so much more. I think we could probably cover this bunch of additional questions. I say that we'll drop down to you, but thank you very much. Where can people find you? I know you're on Twitter. Is that at @hkanji? Is that the best place to look for you, or where do you hang out?
Twitter is easy, but it's hard to message on Twitter unless you're each following each other. Otherwise, LinkedIn or email. The emails is hussein@hoxton.vc.
Amazing. Well, look, thank you, Hussein. Really appreciate your time. It's been wonderful having you here, and I look forward to our next chat. Thanks for listening to Nothing Ventured, an Emerge One production. As always, we'd love to get your feedback on our conversations, your thoughts, as well as topics or guests you'd love to hear from. Drop us a line on social media or via one of the links in the show notes. But for now, be well, and I hope to catch you on the next episode of Nothing Ventured soon. I mean, what have you got to lose, right?